Welcome to Decoding the Big Book, a special limited series of the Sober Friends podcast. Researched and sourced from Writing the Big Book by William Shaberg, the purpose of each episode is to provide context and history for each chapter of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, followed by a reading of the chapter from the fourth edition. Each section is marked by chapters, so feel free to skip ahead to what you're interested in and leave the rest. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous is a pivotal text in the history of addiction recovery. The doctor's opinion section of the book is particularly significant as it provides the testimony of a medical expert stating that the solutions outlined in the book are medically sound. While writing the Big Book, Bill Wilson sought the approval of several medical organizations to write a foreword or preface endorsing the methods presented in the book as a program of action for staying sober. The doctor's opinion is placed front and center of the book because it is considered essential to understand the medical basis of alcoholism before embarking on the journey to recovery. The first edition of the book had a few differences in the doctor's opinion section compared to later editions. In the first section, the doctor's opinion started on page 1, while Bill's story began on its own page 1. Later editions, the doctor's opinion was moved to the Roman numerals with the forewords. The most significant difference between the first edition and later ones is that Dr. Silkworth did not sign his name in the first edition. He was listed as an anonymous doctor. After the second edition, Dr. Silkworth gave permission to use his name as the doctor writing the opinion. William Duncan Silkworth was a respected doctor in his time, and his contribution to the Big Book was instrumental in establishing Alcoholics Anonymous as a legitimate and effective program for recovery. He was born on July 23, 1873 in Brooklyn, New York, and attended Princeton before earning his degree in 1896. Dr. Silkworth graduated from NYU Bellevue Medical School in 1899 and went on to have an illustrious career. In the book Pass It On, he is described as a specialist in neurology, a field that sometimes overlaps with psychiatry. During World War I, he was a member of the psychiatric staff at the U.S. Army Hospital in Plattsburgh, New York for 2 years, 1917 to 1919. It's most likely that he, quote, served as an associate physician at the Neurological Institute Presbyterian Hospital in Manhattan from 1919 to 1929. He also had been connected with Broad Street Hospital, end quote. His start date at Towns Hospital is inconsistently reported as 1924, 1930, or 1932. It seems most credible that Silkworth was laid off by Presbyterian after the market crash of 1929, an event which also vaporized his savings, and that he came to Towns in or after 1930.
Why isn't Dr. Silkworth's name printed at the end of the chapter? His name was just dashed out. The second big burning question is, why was the numbering of the doctor's opinion changed from Arabic numerals, 1, 2, 3, 4, to Roman numerals, XXIII, in the second edition of the Big Book? Why was that change made? Unfortunately, the archives have so far not offered up any answers to those things, which leaves us with only speculation and best guesses.
The doctor's opinion is not only significant for its content, but also for the mystery surrounding why the numbering scheme changed in subsequent editions, and why Dr. Silkworth chose to remain anonymous in the first edition. This begs two questions. Bill Shaberg, author of Writing the Big Book, on his YouTube page, takes a stab at why Dr. Silkworth's name does not appear at the bottom of the doctor's opinion in the first edition.
The most popular guess is that Silkworth's name was not printed at the end of the doctor's opinion because he was so well known as the head physician of Towns Hospital that identifying him as the author might have been seen as an endorsement of that hospital. And they most certainly did not want to be caught out. They was really worried about Bill Wilson's always talking about they're going to be accused of being a racket. Accused of being a racket, a money-making racket, trying to save alcoholics. So they didn't want to be clearly accused of endorsing Towns Hospital. And then the second suggestion People say that they presume that Dr. Silkworth had a reluctance to have his name so closely tied with the fledgling Alcoholics Anonymous. And certainly, Silkworth had published professional articles on his experience and theories about alcoholism, but he still, these people presume, may have felt that putting his professional reputation on the line with this very new and as yet unproven organization was just a bit too risky. So the first suggestion is that the AA people didn't want to put his name in because it might make them look bad as an endorsement for Towns Hospital. The second presumption is that Dr. Silkworth didn't want to put his name in because he was afraid he'd be too closely linked to that, and that might besmirch his character or his reputation in some way. If these are the two most plausible suggestions, and they're the two most plausible suggestions I've ever heard, I would be voting for the first.
And what about the renumbering?
The renumbering of the pages is a bit more complicated.
Schaberg speculates on why the numbering changed for the doctor's opinion.
Perhaps the most plausible reason for this change is the suggestion that the decision to use Roman numerals for the doctor's opinion was driven by the belief that it was important to separate the medical man's opinion from the one drunk talking to another drunk opinions found in the rest of the book. So what people are suggesting was that this decision was made because they wanted to separate and put a kind of a wall between the medical opinion and the alcoholic speaking to other alcoholics' opinions. And someone further speculated to me recently that Bill realized the need to do this as he was writing and as he finished and polished up the 12 traditions, which were adopted in 1950, 5 years before this second edition came out. But that suggestion is just speculation because there is, to my knowledge, no recorded evidence of why this change was made. I haven't seen anything in the archives on that, nor has anyone else brought anything out of the archives to my attention about that.
The book is structured like a recipe, with each chapter building on the next to provide the program. Accepting the tenets of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous requires helping the prospective newcomer understand that what they have is not a moral failing or a lack of willpower, but a medical disease. Breaking through the barrier of moral failing versus medical issue is the first way to connect with them and help them understand that they are not bad people because they drink. The next step is to introduce the idea that knowing you have a problem isn't enough. You have to mix knowing with what the problem is with a spiritual component. Knowledge and spirituality are the only ways to break this malady. Working with others was a key component to Bill's sobriety from the moment he found recovery himself. Using the tenets of the Oxford Group, Bill kept himself sober for 5 months while attempting to work with others, but was not successful in helping anyone else. During this time, Bill took a religious approach with each person, and in 1935, Dr. Silkworth criticized this approach, saying that Bill would scare people away. Dr. Silkworth implored Bill to start with the hard medical facts first, and then talk through the spiritual message. Bill Schaberg, author of the source material on this series, writing the big book, discusses this conversation between Silkworth and Wilson.
Wilson complained bitterly that Dr. Silkworth he just hadn't been able to get anyone sober. He'd been doing all this hard work and nothing was happening. He had no success whatsoever. What's his problem? And the doctor advised him, Bill, you got to stop preaching at them and you got to give them the hard medical facts. Hopefully this will soften them up at death so that they'll be willing to do anything to get well. Then they may accept those spiritual ideas of your faith in God. And then in June of 1935, Bill Wilson goes out to Akron, Ohio, runs into Dr. Bob, and that new approach, which he tried on Dr. Bob Smith, worked perfectly.
Taking this approach, Bill had his first success with Dr. Bob. In conclusion, the doctor's opinion section of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous is an essential piece of the program of recovery. It provides a medical expert's testimony establishing the scientific basis of addiction and the necessity of a spiritual component in recovery. Dr. Silkworth's contribution to the book and the history of addiction recovery is immeasurable, and his anonymity in the first edition only adds to the mystery and intrigue surrounding the origins of the program. The doctor's opinion. We of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that the reader will be interested in the medical estimate of the plan of recovery described in this book. Convincing testimony must surely come from the medical men who have had experience with the sufferings of our members and have witnessed our return to health. A well-known doctor, chief physician at a nationally prominent hospital specializing in alcoholic and drug addiction, gave Alcoholics Anonymous this letter. To who it may concern, I have specialized in the treatment of alcoholism for many years. In late 1934, I attended a patient. Though he had been a competent businessman of good earning capacity, was an alcoholic of a type I had come to regard as hopeless. In the case of his third treatment, he acquired certain ideas concerning a possible means of recovery. As part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others. This has become the basis of a rapidly growing fellowship of these men and their families. This man and over 100 others appear to have recovered. I personally know scores of cases who are of the type with whom other methods had failed completely. The facts appear to be of extreme medical importance because of the extraordinary possibilities of rapid growth inherent in this group. They may mark a new epoch in the annals of alcoholism. These men may well have a remedy for thousands of such situations. You may rely absolutely on anything they say about themselves. Yours truly, William D. Silkworth, M.D. The physician who, at our request, gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement, he confirms what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe, that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality, or were outright mental defectives. Those things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent, with some of us. But we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little. But as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. Though we work out our solutions on the spiritual as well as altruistic plane, we favor hospitalization for the alcoholic who is very jittery or befogged. More often than not, it is imperative that a man's brain be cleared before he is approached, as he has then a better chance of understanding and accepting what we have to offer. The doctor writes, "The subject presented in this book seems to me to be of paramount importance to those afflicted with alcoholic addiction. I say this after many years' experience as medical director of one of the oldest hospitals in the country treating alcoholic and drug addiction. There was, therefore, a sense of real satisfaction when I was asked to contribute a few words on the subject, which is covered in such masterly detail in these pages. We doctors have realized for a long time that some form of moral psychology was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but its application presented difficulties beyond our conception. What with our ultra-modern standards, our scientific approach to everything, we are perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of good that lie outside our synthetic knowledge. Many years ago, one of the leading contributors to this book came under our care in this hospital, and while here, he acquired some ideas which he put into practical application at once. Later, he requested the privilege of being allowed to tell his story to other patients here, and with some misgiving, we consented. The cases we have followed have been most interesting. In fact, many of them are amazing. The unselfishness of these men as we have come to know them, the entire absence of profit motive, and their community spirit is indeed inspiring to one who has labored long and wearily in this alcoholic field. They believe in themselves, and still more, in the power which pulls chronic alcoholics back from the gates of death. Of course, an alcoholic ought to be freed from his physical craving for liquor, and this often requires a definite hospitalization procedure before psychological measures can be of maximum benefit. We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is manifested of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. Once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. Frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. The message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight. In nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves. If any feel that as psychiatrists directing a hospital for alcoholics, we appear somewhat sentimental, let them stand for us a while on the firing line. See the tragedies, the despairing wives, the little children. Let the solving of these problems become part of their daily work, and even their sleeping moments. And the most cynical will not wonder that we have accepted and encouraged the movement. We have found nothing which has contributed more to the rehabilitation of these men than the altruistic movement now growing among them. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented. Unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks, drinks which they see others taking with impunity. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful, with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over, and unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of recovery. On the other hand, and strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules. Men have cried out to me in science and despairing appeal, "Doctor, cannot go on like this. I have everything to live for. I must stop, but I cannot. You must help me." Faced with this problem, if a doctor is honest with himself, he must sometimes feel his own inadequacy. Although he gives all that is in him, it often is not enough. One feels that something more than human power is needed to produce an essential psychic change. Though the aggregate of recoveries resulting from psychiatric effort is considerable, we physicians must admit we have made little impression upon the problem as a whole. Many types do not respond to the ordinary psychological approach. I do not hold with those who believe that alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control. I have had many men who had, for example, worked a period of months on some problem or business deal which was to be settled on a certain date favorably to them. They took a drink a day or so prior to the date, and then the phenomenon of craving at once became paramount to all other interests, so that important appointment was not met. These men were not drinking to escape. They were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control. There are many situations which arise out of the phenomenon of craving which cause men to make the supreme sacrifice rather than continue to fight. The classification of alcoholics seems most difficult and in much detail is outside the scope of this book. There are, of course, the psychopaths who are emotionally unstable. We're all familiar with this type. They are always going on the wagon for keeps. They are over-remorseful and make many resolutions, but never a decision. There is the type of man who is unwilling to admit that he cannot take a drink. He plans various ways of drinking. He changes his brand or his environment. There is the type who always believes that after being entirely free from alcohol for a period of time, he can take a drink without danger. There is the manic depressive type, who is perhaps the least understood by his friends, and about whom a whole chapter could be written. Then, there are types entirely normal in every respect except the effect alcohol has upon them. They are often able, intelligent, friendly people. All these and many others have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. This phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy which differentiates these people and sets them apart in a distinct entity. It has never been, by any treatment with which we are familiar, permanently eradicated. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. This immediately precipitates us into a seething cauldron of debate. Much has been written pro and con, but among physicians, the general opinion seems to be that most chronic alcoholics are doomed. What is the solution? Perhaps I can best answer this by relating one of my experiences. About a year ago, prior to this experience, a man was brought in to be treated for chronic alcoholism. He had but partially recovered from a gastric hemorrhage and seemed to be a case of pathological mental deterioration. He had lost everything worthwhile in his life and was only living, one might say, to drink. He frankly admitted and believed that for him there was no hope. Following the elimination of alcohol, there was found to be no permanent brain injury. He accepted the plan outlined in this book. 1 year later, he called to see me, and I experienced a very strange sensation. I knew this man by name and partially recognized his features, but there all resemblance ended. From a trembling, despairing, nervous wreck had emerged a man brimming over with self-reliance and contentment. I talked with him for some time, but was not able to bring myself to feel that I had known him before. To me, this was a stranger, and so he left me. A long time has passed with no return to alcohol. When I need a mental uplift, I often think of another case brought in by a physician prominent in New York. The patient had made his own diagnosis and, deciding his situation hopeless, had hidden in a deserted barn, determined to die. He was rescued by a searching party and in desperate condition brought to me. Following his physical rehabilitation, he had a talk with me in which he frankly stated he thought the treatment a waste of effort unless I could assure him, which no one ever had, that in the future he would have the willpower to resist the impulse to drink. His alcoholic problem was so complex and his depression so great that we felt his only hope would be through what we then called moral psychology, and we doubted if even that would have any effect. However, he did become sold on the ideas contained in this book. He has not had a drink for many great years. I see him now and then, and he is a fine specimen of manhood, as one could wish to meet. I earnestly advise every alcoholic to read this book through, and though perhaps he came to scoff, he may remain to pray. William D. Silkworth, M.D. Decoding the Big Book is a special limited series of the Sober Friends podcast. It's produced, engineered, written, and narrated by me, Matt J. Source material for Decoding the Big Book is from Writing the Big Book by William Shaber. We'll include a link to this highly recommended book in the show notes. Additional sourcing comes from William Shaber's YouTube channel and the Joe and Charlie Big Book Study Groups. You made it this far into the podcast. That tells me you're a pretty big fan. If you like what we do and you find value in the podcast, consider a donation at buymeacoffee.com/soberfriendspod. Your donation keeps us on the air to help out the new guy and helps us defray some of our costs. If you find value in our podcast, please consider a donation at buymeacoffee.com/soberfriendspod.